Okay, I think I'm going to begin if everyone can hear me. So I'm assuming that everyone can hear me, and I just wanted to first of all begin this week by noting that one can download, I think, most of the sources for this week's class in the box that's labeled Resources for November 22nd. And then you can select each file individually and save it to my computer if you want to. Additionally, during the class, I hope to put up the various sources as well. I also wanted to note that one of the benefits of this type of class, that we're doing it online and live, is that people can go ahead and ask questions during the class. I guess probably the best way to do it, so that it doesn't necessarily that it won't be people won't talk over each other or the like, is probably if they use the chat. And depending on the question, whether or not we're going to cover it anyways, or I can get back, I can answer it right away, I'm happy to do so. As I said, I think that you should be able to download them from the resources. If there is an issue with them, I'm sure we'll be able to work it out by the end of the class, and we'll also make available at some point in time afterwards the ability to download the particular files if you can't do so right now. Last week, we had discussed a particular case of forgery, a particular genre that has been susceptible to the charge of forgery, and that is the genre of chuvos, or responsa literature. And we saw last week that that at various points in time, that the charge of that something that was something had been misattributed to a particular person, and we saw that in the case of the chuvos hagaonim, that was a particularly widespread issue. But on this week, I want to focus on perhaps one of the most celebrated cases of literary forgery in the chuvos genre. In fact, so much so that at least one scholar has, or I assume others have also noted this, that in reality, that the reason why chuvos in general are more susceptible to the charge of forgery is perhaps because the most well-known instance of forgery had to do with a chuva sefer. That is, if it was, this is the mother of all forgeries. And because it happened to have been a chuvos sefer, so therefore the chuvos generally were considerably more suspect, or at least there was a possibility that that was the case. And in particular, I want to talk about the case of the chuvos besamim rosh. The chuvos besamim rosh was first printed in 1793 in Berlin, and I guess that's what the first edition looks like, and I will show you a clear copy in a moment, and where you can get a clear copy for yourselves if you like. And it was reprinted at least on two occasions, possibly three. The second time that it was printed, and we're going to talk about these various editions in due course, the second time that it was printed was in Krakow in 1881, which... that's the title page of that one. And then finally, it was reprinted again in 1983 in Israel this time. And this is the title page of the latest reprint. And again, I will show you a bit clear copies of these in just a moment. Yes, and these all do belong to myself. And why this is particularly important to discuss this case, although, as I mentioned, it's one of the more well-known ones. At the same time, it seems, much as we saw last week where people will level the charge of forgery where there actually is none, in this instance, the opposite can be said to be the case. That is, there are those people that claim that the besamim rosh, that they can somehow demonstrate that the besamim rosh, or people that claim that the besamim rosh is not actually a forgery, that they have ways to demonstrate that it is incorrect to label this particular work as a forgery. And the first example of this, although it's, I agree, it's more in, if we had to categorize, it's more anecdotal than anything else, is the case I seem to be unable to get to the whiteboard here where I want to show you a particular file. I apologize, I'm just having a problem with getting to this whiteboard. The resources pane is blocking it. Okay, just hold on for just 1 second. I'm just having a technical issue right here. I apologize. Okay. And what I am showing you now, I hope that you should all see, and if you don't, please chime in, that this is a bulletin board or the like, known as that Raven, where someone wrote in to demonstrate that they can prove, that they can demonstrate, excuse me, that in fact the B'Tselem Rosh is not a forgery. And the way in which they can demonstrate this, as the letter says, that the B'Tselem Rosh is a forgery committed by Shaul Berlin in 1793, as we said, that's the first time it's been published. And how is it possible that the Sefer B'Tselem Rosh is mentioned by the Nod Yehuda, who died in 1793, the Chacham Tzvi, who died in 1718, and by the Leket Yosher, who lived between the years 1390 and 1469? To falsify an hypothesis, all one needs is one objective proof. All that those who say that the B'Tselem Rosh is a forgery had to do is access the Bialan Responsa and type in Hebrew B'Tselem Rosh and go to reverse chronology to any Achrim prior to 1793. If they found nothing, then they were correct, but if there's a whole slew of references to the Sefer prior to the year 1793, go sloppy research. And if, by the way, if I got a dollar for every Achrim who does quote the B'Tselem Rosh, I'd go an early retirement. So, what we have here is someone is claiming that the way in which they can demonstrate that the B'Tselem Rosh is not actually a forgery is because, assuming that it was published in 1793 and it's a forgery, that means it was written sometime around 1793 when the author, and I neglected to mention this, and we'll get into more of the background in a moment, but this was published in Berlin in 1793 by Schaub and Zvi Hirsch Berlin, and he attributed it to the Rush, the medieval commentator. So if it's truly predates 1793, then one would expect other people quote it prior to its publication. So this person is claiming that through the Bar Ilan Responsa project, he was able to ascertain that in fact earlier commentators cite the B'Tselem Rosh, thereby indicating that these portions of the B'Tselem Rosh must have been known to those earlier commentators even prior to its publication in 1793, thereby making the argument that the first time it appeared was obviously not 1793 and this is not a forgery. Now, the problem with this is as follows. It seems that this is an example of someone who doesn't understand how the Responsa, the Bar Ilan Responsa project works. And this is one of the things that I'd like to discuss tonight generally, and that is the resources that are available today that weren't necessarily available even 30 years ago. And the Bar Ilan Responsa is actually a good example of this. As many people are aware, the Bar Ilan Responsa collects both Responsa literature as well as other literature, and you can do a variety of types of searches to try to locate sources that discuss the particular issue that one is interested in. And in this case, the person that wrote into this message board wrote in and noted that he ran a search on Bar Ilan, and it came up, and this is the search that he ran. You type in the words B'Tselem Rosh, and you get the following tshuvos that supposedly mention the B'Tselem Rosh. If you look at the first one, which is Leket Yosher, which hopefully everyone sees on their screen, and you can see in the highlighted portion that the Leket Yosher presumably quotes the Besamim Rosh, and then the second thing cited here is the Chuvas Shalos and Chuvas Men HaShemayim, which is an interesting work in and of itself, but it's also from one of the Rishonim. And if you look on page 2 again, you see supposedly in the text there's a reference to Bechuvas Besamim Rosh. And then again, as he mentioned in his thing, the Chacham Tzvi is the third example. And again, we have at the end where it says Besamim Rosh, and then finally in the Noda Behuda, again we have the Besamim Rosh. So the argument goes, as I said, is that if these earlier commentators quoted, it must be that they had known about it and it could have been a product of 1793. It must long predate that. Now the problem is that although the Bar-Ilan responds, as I mentioned that we're going to discuss other electronic or newer methodologies that are available today, it is a wonderful project and does allow people to do certain things. However, there's also limitation, aside from its limitations to what it contains and so on, it's also important to note how it works or how it operates. And this is not only a problem with, let's say, the Bar-Ilan, but many times you'll look, especially today with more critical editions of various Svarim that have been reprinted, a lot of times only if you read the introduction carefully can you know what exactly they've added or changed based on their own presumptions. It may be that it'll be in a slightly different font, or there'll be an asterisk, or the like, and you have to know what all these signals mean. And the Bar-Ilan responsive project is no different. And that is, if you look at every time that the Besamim Rosh is quoted in these various sources, you'll notice that a plus sign appears both before as well as after. And if we go through all of them, I mean, it's very easy to see. You can see in the second one here, Bechuvas Besamim Rosh, then it goes on to have the quote, and then at the end of the quote, there's another plus sign. And these plus signs appear throughout these sources. And the third one, it's the same, ayin, etc. And what these... the reason for the plus signs is to indicate that not only did the responsa project include the actual texts of all of these responses and the other sources that includes, but the editors actually added in their own notes. But rather than footnote them, that is, rather than have a number and then it's clear that it's going to a footnote, instead what they did, also I assume because it makes it easier to search perhaps, they included their notes in the text. So how do they delineate what's the original author's words and what their notes are? Very simply, that they put plus signs before and after. The plus signs are, as it was, brackets to indicate that they're not actually part of the text. So therefore, all these sources that supposedly quoted the Besamim Rosh do not actually quote the Besamim Rosh. These are merely editorial glosses of those working on the Bar-Ilan responsa project. So, as far as I'm aware, the Bar-Ilan responsa project is a fairly recent vintage and was not invented in 1793 or even before then. So therefore, any time that these words appear that are referenced to the Besamim Rosh in earlier books than 1793, those are merely the additions, the editorial glosses of the people working on the Bar-Ilan responsa project. So therefore, the inclusion of the Besamim Rosh or the cite to the Besamim Rosh in these sources is absolutely meaningless when it comes to the question of whether or not the Besamim Rosh is actually a forgery or is not a forgery. So this is just an example of extremely poor research and a total misapprehension of what's included in the responsa project from Bar-Ilan. Now, in fact, this is not the only time that we have someone attempting to rehabilitate the Besamim Rosh using extremely faulty research. And this next example comes from the third edition of the Besamim Rosh. As I mentioned, that the three editions, the first one being in 1793, the next one being in 1881, and then finally the most recent reprint in 1983. And in this 1983 reprint, it includes a photo reproduction of the original 1793 text, as well as a lengthy introduction discussing the history of the text, as well as attempt to rehabilitate this work. And the way in which the editor attempts to rehabilitate the work, is by dealing with one of the more well-known lines against the Besamim Rosh. And that is that in the Chuvos of the Chasam Sofer, that is one of the sources that people marshal to show that the Summon Rosh is actually a forgery, is the responsa, a responsa and a reference to the Besamim Rosh in the Tshuvos of the Chasam Sofer. And as I mentioned, the Besamim Rosh is attributed to the Rosh, Reb Asher ben Yechiel. And Reb Asher ben Yechiel, and so therefore, the way to refer to it would be Kisvei HaRosh, the writings of the Rosh. That is, the Besamim Rosh are attributed to the Kisvei HaRosh. Now, they refer to it Kisvei HaRosh. Excuse me. So the way in which the Chasam Sofer refers to the Besamim Rosh when he cites it in one particular tshuva is not Kisvei HaRosh with a saf, that is the writings of the Rosh, but instead he refers to it as Kisvei HaRosh with a Zion, that is the lies or the forgeries of the Rosh, clearly indicating that he took a very negative view towards the authenticity, with regard to the authenticity of the Besamim Rosh. So, then, as I mentioned, this is one of the more well-known statements in opposition to the authenticity of the Besamim Rosh. So this editor of the 1983 edition attempts to deal with this. And the method that he employs is particularly troubling. And as follows. He says, and I'll summarize and then I'll show you what he's actually talking about. He says that if you look in the Vienna edition of the Besamim Rosh, of the Chasam Sofer, excuse me, you'll see that in the Vienna edition of the Chasam Sofer, Tshuvos of the Chasam Sofer, it doesn't say Kisvei, that is the lies with the Zion. Rather, it has it as one would normally speak about the writings of the Rosh, that is Kisvei HaRosh. Now, this actually pays to read his full thing here, and let me just get there. He says as follows, and this is the fourth line of his introduction on the page that we're looking at here, and says as follows. Sorry, I'm just trying to find the correct line. Yes, it's actually the first line here. Umashi chiso hagonim avu bno zal lachsam sofer shakar lahav samin rosh kizvei harosh. That's which people claim that the Chasam Sofer refers to it as the Kisvei HaRosh, that is, the lies of the Rosh. V'hinei kavanasam l'dibrei HaChasam Sofer v'shut arachayim simin kufnun dala dibra machal v'chein. And this is a reference to what's found in the Tshuvos Chasam Sofer, simin 154, where it says, V'hinei sh'olu zelukucha mikisvei HaRosh v'sefer b'samon Rosh simin yudches. So he says, it really reads, the original reads as it was, from the writings of the Rosh, not from the Kisvei, not from the lies. And how does he know this? V'nitfas Kisvei Yodzayin V'tol Sofer. This is an error. And this is also the Girsa, this is also the text that I, this editor, has in front of him. And what edition is that? That's the Vienna Tofresh Nun Hei, which translates roughly to 18 Vienna, 1895. So in other words, what he's saying, and then he says, that which you find in other editions that it says, Kisvei HaRosh, that is the lies of the Rosh, Nero Pasha to tell us so for who? He says, either it's an error, oh, Shematfisa biyosi yadua lalaz al sefer b'sam rosh, ser mi daito shakachi agirsa. So what he says is, or perhaps some publisher decided, based on the rumors and innuendo surrounding the Besamim Rosh, that it must be the Chasam Sofer when he wrote Kisvei, the writings, it must have really been an error, and he went ahead, the editor, and changed on his own accord to switch it to Kisvei. Now, this is particularly shocking for the following reason, and let me just back up and explain. So,
essentially what he seems to be implying is that the most legitimate edition is the Vienna 1895 edition, where it actually reads Kisvei, that is the writings, with the Suf. Now, he doesn't tell you which edition of the Chasam Sofer, the Tshuvos of the Chasam Sofer, is actually the first or the earlier edition. Instead, by implication, he seems to be saying that for some reason the Vienna edition either is the first or it's the most authentic edition of the Tshuvos Chasam Sofer. Now, this is where we get to, I think, something that's somewhat important, but for the most part is ignored all too often, and that is the need to know something, at least a minimal level, and I'll explain how today it's even easier, about bibliography. And the way in which someone would go ahead and check, how would someone find out which edition the Vienna 1895 edition is? So today, actually, this is today it's actually significantly simpler than it used to be, because it used to be that one could only go to various books that would list the various editions of books, basically bibliographies, as the name implies. Today, though, it's become somewhat easier for two basic reasons. Both have to do with both the computer and the internet. The first is that in the case of locating whether or not, let's say, the 1895 edition of the Chasam Sofer is the earliest or not, if one goes to any major library's catalog, one can do a search on the Tshuvos Chasam Sofer and see whether or not, in fact, what they have, and presumably they're going to have at least many of the early editions, and one can see whether or not they have anything dating prior to Vienna 1895. In addition, there are many sites online that actually provide entire books online. Most people are aware of Google Books. When it comes to Svarim, there's HebrewBooks.org, there's SvarimOnline.org, and Google Books actually contains many Svarim. And then particularly the best source out of all these, though, is the Jewish National University Library, University Library of Hebrew University. They have a digitization project that they've actually digitized many, many books online. And the reason why that is better than, let's say, Google Books or HebrewBooks.org, I'll show you this in a moment, is because they actually are extremely careful about what they put up. The books that they put up are, for the most part, complete, and they're not missing pages, as can be the case with any of the other work, either Google or HebrewBooks.org. Additionally, when it comes to Google Books, their selection is very eclectic, especially when it comes to Hebrew books. And when it comes to HebrewBooks.org, there are two problems, one of which is that they're not always careful about ensuring that the copy that they put up is the best copy. And then second of all, there seems to be the potential that some of their books are either put up or removed based on ideological concerns. And I'll show you a couple examples tonight that it seems that they actually haven't caught yet, so currently they're online. But now turning to the Chasam Sofer, and whether or not the Vienna edition is actually the first edition or there's an earlier edition, as one would imagine, as I've sort of been alluding to, there indeed is an earlier edition. And this edition, and the file name of this file, and again, as I mentioned, anyone can download it from the resources thing, and this is it's labeled Krakow Edition PDF. Excuse me, it's not... It's my mistake. It's labeled Vienna Chasam Sofer, and Vienna Chasam Sofer PDF. And that is, as you can see on the first page, is indeed the site or is a reproduction of the Vienna 1895 edition. And as you can see, Emoto Lashvisam Hanoser Batar, Vihine Shaila Zula Kucha Mikisve Harosh Shibisafer Bisamim Rosh Simen Yudzain. As you can see, he indeed correctly recorded that the Vienna edition, 1895, has Kisvei, the writings, and not Kisvei, the lies. So, one of the classic works on bibliography, at least until recently, was the work called Beis Eked Svarim. And this is a page from Beis Eked Svarim. And we're looking at the Tshuvos Chasam Sofer, and he's going to list the various prints, the various editions of the Tshuvos Chasam Sofer. And as you can see, on the top here, in entry 1302 in letter Ches, the first edition was in Pressburg, Tafresh Tesvov, which is 1856. So around 40 years prior to the Vienna edition, which as you can see, it's the last underlined entry here. So it was the, it looks like, it was Pressburg in as I mentioned, in 1856, and then prior to that was Yerodea, and then you have, it goes through all the various editions, and then in all six together, indeed, the Vienna edition was the first time that all six were printed together. That is, all six volumes of the Chuvah Chasam Sofer, but important for our purposes, the Vienna edition is not the first edition of the Chuvah Chasam Sofer. And indeed, if you look at the first edition of the Chuvah Chasam Sofer, which this is a reprint of, a photocopy of, and as you can see, this is Pressburg, 1856. And on the page, and I'll come back to the page to explain the unique stamp in just a moment, you can see in the box, Hema, let me just pull this up, it says, Hema ke'ilu eina mimoto lashvis hanosa b'tar v'hine shalos l'kucha mikizve, from the lies of the Rush. So in other words, in the first edition, the first printed edition of the Chuvah Chasam Sofer, it has Kizve, that is, the lies of the Rush. Now, it is equally correct that the Vienna edition, which is later, does have Kizve. However, there is nothing that we can point to in the Vienna edition that makes it any more authoritative than the earlier Pressburg edition. And in particular, this whole question, or this whole discussion, really, is absurd, because this is not the only time in which the Chasam Sofer discusses the Besamim Rosh. Indeed, in another tshuva, which I'll come to in just one moment, he actually says, Ubezeh nizdayef sefer Besamim Rosh. And with this, I can show that the tshuva's Besamim Rosh is a forgery. That is, his ultimate conclusion in another responsa, which I will get to in just one moment, is that the Besamim Rosh is a forgery. So therefore, he states explicitly that he thinks it's a forgery. And whether or not he says over here, Kisve or Kizve, that is, the writings are lies, it doesn't really matter because it's clear, his position is clear from his other statement. Now, just before moving on, it's just worthwhile of noting, if any of you noticed in the page beforehand, you can see that on the title page of this Chuvah Chasam Sofer, there's actually a swastika and a stamp. The reason for that is, you can see this from time to time if you visit certain libraries, and that is that the Nazis during the Holocaust actually collected a fair amount of Hebrew books, and they kept them all in a single place, and after the Holocaust they were discovered, and there was a whole debate about what to do about some of them, but in many of them, they were dispersed throughout various libraries in the United States, various libraries that had some sort of Jewish population that would use them. So numerous libraries ranging from Lakewood to the Jewish Theological Seminary to JTS all received books that at one point in time were actually held by the Nazis. This copy comes from the Library of Congress here in D.C., and the Library of Congress was among the libraries that received some of these books, and that's why it has that particular stamp. But now, returning to this question of the Chasam Sofer over here, what we see from this particular case is again that if he had looked up in the as we saw in Beis Eked, that there's actually an earlier edition of the Chasam Sofer, then it perhaps would have lent, or perhaps the editor would have paused for a moment and thought that maybe the Vienna edition isn't as authoritative as he made it appear to be. Now, what's fascinating is as I mentioned, bibliography can be somewhat important. And in fact, although there were earlier bibliographies, one of the earliest, as it was, of the critical or the scientific editions or the scientific bibliographies of Hebrew books was a bibliography by Ben Yaakov, which is known as Otzah Sfarim. And although it's literally a bibliography, much like you saw in the case of the Beis Eked, where it's entries about, you know, various editions and who the author is and when they were printed, at the same time, it's not a book that you would think that necessarily would carry a haskama. But in fact, Ben Yaakov's book actually does have a haskama from some leading rabbis of Vilna, where the book was published. And one of them actually explains why he's giving the Haskama. And this is the Haskama, the longer Haskama from Shlomo HaKohen. And in it, he actually explains, he was one of the leading rabbis in Vilna at the time, that that various people made errors based upon the fact that they were unfamiliar with Hebrew bibliography. In recent years, a particularly egregious case was a Kollel, I forgot the name, it was Kollel, I don't remember the name of it now, that they reprinted a sefer called the Madani Asher. And the Madani Asher is a case, which we're going to talk about later on, is a case that was, it was a sefer that allegedly was plagiarized from another sefer called Shochana Atzei Shittim. But this Kollel reprinted in a very nice edition the Madani Asher, which is the work that was allegedly plagiarized. And someone actually in the journal Moriah points out that they spent all this time and all this money on reprinting a work that it's really highly questionable whether or not it deserves to be reprinted because the work itself may be a work of plagiarism. Now, as I mentioned today, it's actually significantly easier to find out these sorts of things, and the easiest way to do that today is that there's a phenomenal resource. It's called the Hebrew Bibliographical Project. And what they did is they have both a CD as well as online. They have entries. You can search either by the author, the title, and all other manners of the, who gave Haskamas and the like. And aside from providing just the basic publication information, there are also extensive notes in many of the entries that are actually extremely helpful, either about articles written about the particular books or about interesting things about the books. For example, whether or not a book would be, whether or not people had charged that it was plagiarized or it was forged, like we're talking about the Besamim Rosh. Additionally, as I mentioned, it's fairly easy also to search through various libraries' catalogs to see whether or not one, you know, their earlier editions or their other critical editions, perhaps, that someone wants to look at. For a history of bibliography, of Jewish or Hebrew bibliography in particular, there's actually a very nice work in English. It's by a guy by the name of Simeon Brisman, B-R-I-S-M-A-N, and he has something called A History and a Guide to Jewish Bibliography, Hebrew Bibliography. And it's an excellent overview of the history of bibliography. And then additionally, for example, since we are talking about Tshuvas, it's worthwhile mentioning that of late there's been a collection called Kuntres HaTshuvas, which is a bibliography of the various of the response to literature. And this was ostensibly to update what was known as the Kuntres HaTshuvas, which was done by Boaz Cohen around 80 years ago. And to update his work. Now, the Kuntres HaTshuvas in and of itself is interesting because it's published in three volumes and covers a tremendous amount of ground. And some of the entries are absolutely excellent. Some of the entries really have a phenomenal, phenomenal amount of information, both about the content of the works, as well as variants or history of either the author or for example, if which is extremely helpful. For example, if there's a particularly unique responsa or responsum in a particular work, and sometimes that engendered a huge controversy, sometimes they'll cite to all the other literature on it. So now, once you look there, you can actually find a significant amount of material that discusses the particular issue that one may be interested in. Unfortunately, as I said, some of the entries are very, very well done. Other, it's a very uneven book. Some of the other entries are very poor. And some of their, you know, and it isn't necessarily based upon whether or not the book is in and of itself an important book. Some unimportant works have very nice entries and some very important works have very poor entries. And, you know, and it just overall an extremely uneven body of literature. That said, it's still, you know, if one is looking up a tshuva or the like, it definitely is worthwhile to go ahead and look at it. But for example, turning to the Besamim Rosh, this is actually an example of where the Kuntres HaTshuvas is particularly poor. It fails to mention something that is very important. And that is, as I mentioned, there is a another tshuva from the Besamim Rosh, where the Besamim Rosh actually, excuse me, there's another tshuva from the Chassam Sofer, where the Chassam Sofer explicitly says that Ubizeh Nisdayif Sefer Besamim Rosh. And with this I can demonstrate that the tshuva's Besamim Rosh is a forgery. And which tshuva is this? So the Chassam Sofer is talking about one of the most well-known tshuvas of the Besamim Rosh. Indeed, it seems to be the normative practice today at least one can trace back to the Besamim Rosh, or the articulation that appears in the Besamim Rosh. And the particular practice that I'm discussing, it has to do with what happens to a suicide. So if a person commits suicide, the traditional view was that one shouldn't be involved in his burial, and that and other forms of mourning are inappropriate, because suicide was viewed extremely negatively by Jews and by other religions as well. And however, the Besamim Rosh actually has a responsum where he explains that today that the majority of people that commit suicide, and again, this is attributing it to the Rosh, in other words, there's no indication, and again, we'll get into exactly how we know or how we don't know about this, but attributing it to the Rosh all the way back to that period, that that the reason why people commit suicide is not for theological or philosophical, he refers to it as philosophical reasons, that is, that they have some philosophical problem with life in general. Rather, the reason why people do it is because, a very modern view, people are depressed, and depression is an illness, and therefore you can't fault the person for suicide, and thus none of the laws that have traditionally been applied to a suicide are today applicable to a suicide. That's what the Besamim Rosh says. Now, this tshuva, and this is, as I said, will be an example of both why the Quintuset Tshuvas, unfortunately, is very uneven, as well as some of the limitations that we have with online research. And that is that, as I mentioned, there are really two editions there are three editions of the Besamim Rosh, but the third edition, as I mentioned, is merely a photo mechanical reproduction of the first edition. So there are two editions, the first edition being Berlin, 1793, the second edition being Krakow, 1881. Now, there is a distinction between the Krakow edition and the Berlin edition. In the Krakow edition, two tshuvos have been removed, one of which is the tshuva having to do with suicide, which is Shin, Ayin, He. And that does not appear in the Krakow edition. Now, what's fascinating is that that's fairly important. And if you're looking at an entry in the Kuntres HaTshuvos about the Besamim Rosh, they make no mention of the fact that if you're looking at the Krakow edition, you're lacking two tshuvos. Now, if one looks at the Krakow edition, and I'll show you a scan from it in just a moment, if one looks at the Krakow edition closely, this will be apparent, because although the editors decided to remove the two tshuvos, they neglected to change the index in the back. So the index in the back references both of the missing tshuvos. However, when you look in the text, those tshuvos are actually missing. And I'm going to show you a scan now of that tshuva. And this is the file titled Krakow Edition. As you can see on this page, you'll notice that it, aside from not changing the index, they're also extremely lazy and they didn't change the numbering of the tshuva. So we have Besamim Rosh Simen Shin Mem Dalet, and the one that follows it is Besamim Rosh Simen Shin Mem He. So in other words, they leave out Shin Mem He. And similarly, with regard to Shin Ayin He, you have Besamim Rosh Shin Ayin Dalet, and then the next page is the Besamim Rosh Shin Ayin Vav. So it jumps over Shin Ayin He, which is the tshuva that I mentioned having to do with suicide. But if you look at the index, you can see right here, Shin Mem He, the circled text, Inyan Mavet Atzmo Ladas, that is, with regard to someone who commits suicide, and Shin Mem He. But of course, in the actual text, as we saw, this particular edition actually leaves it out. Now, this is aside from the fact that the Krakow edition leaves it out. This is why it's important to know about the various editions and also the limitations of online research. And that is that if you go to the HebrewBooks.org, you can see hopefully on the screen now that they indeed have the Shilohs and Shulis B'Samim Rosh. Unfortunately, in the publication place and the publication data on the right side of the page, they claim this is the Berlin 1793 edition. Now, in reality, this is not. This is a photocopy of the Krakow edition, the edition that's missing two Shulis. So if one's looking, trying to find those particular Shulis, if one's trying to, you know, if they see a citation for it or the like, or they just want to read through it, you can see that it's actually lacking this particular edition, although there's no notation that it's actually the Krakow edition. Indeed it is. Now, if one actually wants to see the complete edition, one can do so online. One just has to know where to go. And that is, as I mentioned, and this is why it's more important perhaps than at times than Hebrew books, is the Jewish National University Library's digitized book repository. And what you have here is the entry for this particular book. And this indeed is the 1793 edition. And this has all the pages from that particular edition, and it has all the tshuvas. So what we have over here is this particular statement of the B'Samim Rosh that again is attributed to the Rosh that says that in the case of suicide that the laws don't apply. Now one can see already a certain tendency or a particular position that should be fairly obvious why it may rub people the wrong way. And as I mentioned, the Exam Sofer says as follows, and this is from the Exam Sofer. It's found in the Chula Exam Sofer Yardeya Simin Shin Chavav, as well as in Ebn Ezer Simon Shin Samachtas, and he says that he can demonstrate conclusively that this particular halachic position is incorrect. That is, the halachic position that says that if one commits suicide because of pain or because of depression or the like, that all the laws of suicide don't apply. He says that with the famous case of Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, that he says he refused, so there's this famous case that he was wrapped up in a Sefer Torah, and they placed wet cloths around his heart, and they lit him on fire in a way to, the reason why for the wet cloths was to prolong his pain prior to death. And it says that Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan didn't open his mouth even so that the fire wouldn't come closer, so instead he would actually live longer if he would do nothing to bring his death any closer. And in fact, then it says that the person standing next to him, the Roman or the Greek, whatever it was, guard, grabbed it and he took them away and he jumped in with them. And it said that both Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan as well as this non-Jewish person who had assisted him were both going to Olam Haba. So the Chassam Sofer points out, though, that you see that if it is correct that suicide, that the law or that suicide or the prohibition against suicide is suspended in instances because it's because of a medical condition or because of extreme pain or depression, so why didn't Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan hasten his death? So you see, he says, based upon this, ubezen is daif sefer b'samim rosh simin shin mem hei. Umuchach dafilu hameitzer b'yosu mikol mokom rotzeach hu meis b'rishasa. He says that this case proves that even if you're in extreme pain, you can't do anything to bring one's death closer. So this is fascinating, because he isn't saying that the reason that I know that the tshuvas b'samim rosh is a forgery is because, for example, I examined the manuscript. Or, for example, there is no manuscript. The author was unable to produce an actual manuscript. Or there's other internal indicia that indicate that this is a forgery. Rather, it's because of the fact that this seems to disagree with one's particular interpretation of the law. So this is what the Chassam Sofer does. And this is particularly risky, I would say, because many people, not necessarily in defense of the B'Samim Rosh, but just in the defense of the underlying rule over here, point out that one can understand the case of Rav Hanina ben Trajan, that it was merely midas chasidus, that was, he was going above and beyond what he had to do, that he really could have done that. Or there are other ways of explaining away this particular source that the Chassam Sofer proves conclusively. Because as one can imagine, what one person thinks is an explicit statement that seems to go against this statement that appears in the Psalm of Rosh, other people can find other ways of explaining it away, and therefore supposedly the conclusive proof really is inconclusive at best. So here we have the difficulty, as it was, in trying to discern whether or not the Besamim Rosh is actually a forgery or it's not a forgery. Because how do we go about doing that? What methods do we have to go about and figuring out why it is that the Besamim Rosh would or wouldn't be a forgery? And in this particular case, in order to fully understand why the charge of forgery was leveled at this particular book, it's important to know some of the background. In reality, the Besamim Rosh was not the first literary effort of Schaub and Zvi Hirsch Berlin, the editor as well as the commentator on the Besamim Rosh. Let me explain. The Besamim Rosh is actually divided up into two different parts. The first part is, as one would expect, the actual tshuvos from attributed to the Rosh, and that's the Besamim Rosh portion, as it was. In addition, the editor or creator, depending on how one views the response of whether or not they truly are from the Rosh or not, wrote his notes on these tshuvos. In other words, he has a whole commentary. He has a commentary on these responsa that are attributed to the Rosh. And that commentary is called Kasa Daharsana, which literally means a fish dip. And it's a term that appears in the Talmud on a few occasions. And so in other words, so the Besamim Rosh itself is divided up into two parts. One is the responsa, and the other is clearly the work of Schaub and Zvi Hirsch Berlin. Now, Schaub and Zvi Hirsch Berlin, just so everyone is aware, because this will be important in just a moment, Zvi Hirsch, his father, was the chief rabbi of Berlin, and very, very well known, and they were also very well connected both through family relations and as well as on his own. He was highly respected. His other son became chief rabbi in England, and the family itself was very, very, it's a very well respected rabbinic family. And Shaul, the editor, was also the rabbi of Frankfurt am Main. So he himself was respected, but as I mentioned, the Besamim Rosh was not his first literary effort, and this is important because, as we'll see in a moment, his first literary effort was also even perhaps more controversial than the Besamim Rosh. And his first literary effort was actually a work called Mitzvei Yoktsiel. And this was published earlier, and it was done as an attack on another book. That is the chief rabbi of the Triple Community. There is a community comprised of three different cities, Altona, Hamburg, and then Wandsbek. And they were known as, by their initials, Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. So in Hebrew, it's Aleph Hei Vav, or Ehu. And the chief rabbi was Rafal Hamburger. And he wrote a sefer called Torah Sikusiel, which is a commentary on the halachas of Yeridea. And it's actually a fairly unremarkable work. He has other works that are perhaps less conventional. He has a work on grammar called Marbe Lashon, but this one was a conventional work really on Yeridea. And I think it was 12 years after Torah Sikusiel was published, a work attributed to a person by the name of Avadia ben Baruch came out, and that was titled Mitzvei Yoktsiel. And this work attempted to show that the Torah Sikusiel, that is the work of the chief rabbi of the Triple Community, was full of inaccuracies, that it was just littered with leniencies that had no basis. He accused the author of plagiarism, of not knowing what he was doing. He accused him of, and in part the reason why his work was so poor, that is the work of the chief rabbi of the Triple Community, was because he took bribes and other personal attacks. And as I mentioned, the author that appears on the front, on the title page, is Avadia ben Baruch. And I will show you, this is actually, this book, this Mitzvei Yoktsiel, Although it's extremely, it does not hold the Rebbe Hamburg at all in very high regard, for some reason, this actually one can get today on HebrewBooks.org. And that is right here. Hopefully you can all see this, and you can download it at your leisure. You can see that what you have here is the title page of the Sefer Mitzvah Yaksiel, which it's incorrect to say, by the way, it's not Mitzvah Yikusiel, that is the person, instead it's a place that's mentioned in Yehoshua. And it's Hasagos HaSefer Toras Yikusiel, by Rafal HaKoyen, Al Bezden DeShelosh Kilos DeShelosh Kilos Ehu, that is Alkana Hamburg Wandsbeck. And you can see Chobru HaRabbanim HaDayan HaMetzion Avadya Berab Baruch in Berlin. And this was published in 1789. And as I said, it was an extremely personal attack on the chief rabbi. Now, the chief rabbi, as well as the community of Hamburg, was extremely offended by this particular book. And they put Avadya Bar Baruch, Avadya the son of Baruch, the ostensive author of this book, in Cheder. And in fact, if anyone wants now, you can actually purchase, as far as I know, the only, the only known copy of this, or I also accept gifts, at the Sotheby's auction, which will be this Tuesday. And this is a Psak Mi Bezdin Tzedek. You can see this is, as well as a kruz, and it's signed by the various Dayanim. And this is a Psak Bezdin, a Cherem. This is the actual Cherem, an original copy of it. And as I said, it's up for auction this Tuesday. It looks like the estimate's between $5,000 and $7,000. And what it is against the author of the summit of the Mitzvah Yaksiel. And it goes into it puts that particular person who offended Hagon Hamafursim, you can see in bold, Hamafursim Kavod, Marina Rav, Rafal Hakoin, all the negative things he said. So therefore they're putting him in Cheir. Now, what's fascinating is that they weren't the only ones to put in Cherem. And by the way, aside from downloading this, which is the file by the name of Sotheby's, you can also, Sotheby's has a website, and you can go ahead and download their full catalog. And as you can see, which lot number this is, and you can also obtain it that way as well. But what they did was they put the ostensive author of Avadya ben Baruch in Cherem. Now, aside from Hamburg, they also went ahead and tried to solicit the views of other rabbis and place this author that attacked the rabbi, the triple community, in Cheirim. So one of the people that they went to was Zvi Hirsch Berlin. And in fact, the way that the story goes is that Rabbi Zvi Hirsch was ready to sign on to the Cheirim. And someone whispered into his ear, this is literally the way that it read, and says, oh, by the way, Kishol, who, and it's a pasuk that they're referencing, that instead he should know prior to signing this that, by the way, the guy that wrote this is your son. So needless to say, he did not sign on to the ban. And in fact, what's fascinating is although you would think that this is really just a footnote in history, this particular case is fairly important for a very important legal concept. Because after Zvi Hirsch decided not to sign on, Rav Shaul and Rav Zvi Hirsch, as well as others, the Noid Behuda, who was, I think, their uncle, or related some way, fairly directly, argued that, remember, if you recall, Zvi Hirsch as well as Shaul were in Berlin. The Bezdin that pronounced this Cheirim was in Hamburg. So they argued, and they had two arguments, and the second one I'll get to in just a moment, but their first argument was, is that there's a limit, Bezdin, there are inherent geographic limits to Bezdin's power. So a Bezdin in Hamburg does not have the right or the power to place a resident of a different city in Cheirim. That is, their power is limited to their geographic location. In second law, you have a similar idea of personal jurisdiction, that courts only have jurisdiction over inhabitants of their state or their particular districts. And over here, too, they made the argument that the Bezdin in Hamburg has no ability to put anyone in Cheirim outside of their city. They also made a secondary argument that these sorts of attacks, although they may be deemed personal, these sorts of attacks one can find throughout rabbinic literature, that various people attack other people in the course of a Torah discussion, sometimes things get fairly heated and they may even get personal, and that's not a reason, is not a reason enough to go ahead and attack, and to place someone in Chayrim. So now, what we have though is that, and in fact it is correct, as far as we can tell, that, that Shaul Berlin did indeed author this, Mitzvah Yaksiel, and it was an attack on the Chief Rabbi of Hamburg. Now, it's unclear why he did this. There are various theories, none of them are all that satisfying. In other words, why attack this particular book of this particular rabbi? So some claim because Shaul Berlin was part of the early Haskalah movement, and that was developing in Berlin, and some of the Maskilim viewed Raphael Hamburger as one of the big opponents of Haskalah, so therefore this was a way to attack him and undermine his authority. Others claim, well, the problem with this is that many of the attacks are on leniencies that Raphael Hamburger articulates. And one would expect more that if he truly was so lenient, that he wouldn't necessarily be viewed as so so anti-modernity or some of the things that Shaul Berlin actually articulates later on in his B'Samim Rosh. Others say that, and the other issue is because there was such a large gap in time between the publication of the Torah Sukusiel and the Mitzvah Yaksiel, it's rather odd to attack it so many years later. Now, it does seem that it was actually designed to undermine the authority of Raphael Hamburger, but again, his motivations are unclear, and the reason why we know it's definitely designed to undermine his authority not only amongst the Maskilim, but even throughout, as it was at the time, much of European Jewry, is that if one actually looks at the Mitzvah Yaksiel, you'll see that it was actually sent out, that when these copies were created, they have a list of rabbis that they sent copies to, as it was to demonstrate, the author wanted to demonstrate to everyone, he wasn't afraid, he was willing to share his work with all the great rabbis at the time, the Vilna Gaon's included on this list, as well as others, that they would get copies of this, and the point of the author, as he notes in this introduction, is let the readers decide who's actually right. Is Avadia Barbara slash Shaul Berlin correct? Or is Raphael Hamburger, who's right about Jewish law in this particular issue? So needless to say, though, because this was an attack on one of the venerable rabbis of the time, it didn't necessarily create a whole lot of goodwill for Shaul Berlin in the rabbinic circles. Which is why, then, it's somewhat odd that if it's true that Shaul Berlin actually forged the B'Samim Rosh, what the point of that would be. In other words, after he's already suspect because he wrote this diatribe against Raphael Hamburger, did he really think that this was going to go unnoticed, that people would just swallow it whole as it was? Or perhaps they had a different motivation. Perhaps one could turn it on its head and argue actually that Shaul Berlin actually did not forge it, and or perhaps he received a copy that was corrupt perhaps, but he himself didn't do it, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for a person that's already suspect to go ahead and put something out that would only feed that sort of questions about himself. Now, obviously, we've only and I see that we're almost out of time. We've only really touched upon the outskirts of what the B'Samim Rosh actually is, as well as Shaul Berlin. But I will leave you this week with just one thought. With regard to the B'Samim Rosh and with regard to forgeries in general. And that is the comment that he's not the only one to actually say this, but other people later on say something very similar. And that is Rabbi Matisyahu Strausun, who is the son of Rabbi Shmuel Strausun, the Rashash, who appears in the back of his Haggadahs, appear in the back of the Gemara. And Matisyahu is also appear in the back of Baba Basra in the standard edition of the Vilna Shas. He himself, Matisyahu Strausun, but he, as well as his father, the Rishash, although he to a significantly greater degree, Matisyahu was a huge collector of Hebrew books. He had a phenomenal library, and in fact, the catalog of the books in his library was printed, and it may even be online now, listing all the books that he had. And his library was eventually absorbed into the Vilna, Community Library. And it was actually almost entirely saved during the Holocaust. It wasn't until after the Holocaust that it was broken up. And there was a fight between Avram Harkavy, who Matsios Jassoon didn't have any children, and Harkavy was his closest relative. And Yivo, they both claimed that they were the heirs to this particular library. And it seems that there was some sort of compromise that was reached where part of the library went to Harkavy, who in turn donated to Heichal Shlomo, and part of the library went to Yivo. Now today, none of this really matters because in the past couple of years, both of these institutions have begun either completely sold off their holdings of the Strauss-Sohn collection or have begun to sell off parts of their holdings of the Strauss-Sohn collection. So it again is being redispersed as it was from both of these places. But be it as it may, Matsios Strauss-Sohn, aside from writing commentary on Shas, as I mentioned, part of it appears in the back of Bava Basra. He also wrote notes on a history of Vilna. There's a history of Vilna called Kirya Ne'emana, by Shmuel Yosef Fun. And he has notes in the back of Matsios Strauss-Sohn. And he says as follows with regard to the B'Samim Rosh, and as I mentioned, this is important not only for the B'Samim Rosh, but also for everything else. And with this, we're going to finish. It says, this is just at the top of the page that hopefully is up on all your screens. It says as follows, V'achar kol eile yesh lahar, ki af im nechlat shekol ha-sefer me reshiso ad achriso, ma'isi yedei Rav Shaul heinu. That even if this is true, that everything here is really the product of Shaul Berlin, lo nuchal litchoso kela achriyah chalila, we can't just brush it away and say that it's worthless. That they're really enjoyable. That in truth, the smell of the wonderful smell of spices comes out from it. And he says, he essentially says, and we're just out of time here, and you can read this for yourselves. He says that it's full of great stuff. So it may be true that it's not attributable to the rush, but at the same time, isn't it the content that matters more than who said it? And if the content is good, shouldn't that be all that matters? So that's just a thought to think about generally when it comes to these cases of forgery. Does it really matter who we attribute something to, or does it only matter what the content is? And hopefully next week we'll explore this a little bit more. And as I said, if anyone has any questions or anything, please feel free to either put it in the chat, or the email address is svarimblog, svorimblog at gmail.com. It's again S as in Sam, E, F as in Frank, orimblog at gmail.com. Please feel free to ask me any questions, and I hopefully will be able to answer them either via the chat or by email, and I look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you.